This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of July 10th, here are a few top stories. Arizona is fighting for its share of an increase in shipping revenue from Mexico that will have implications for the entire desert Southwest. But that expected increase will bring new infrastructure demands to the state's three shipping ports. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Michelle Marisco reports on a pair of ambitious projects along the state's border with Mexico that officials hope will keep cross-border shipping in Arizona as the state faces new competition for Mexico's goods from its neighbors.
Washington, D.C. and Mexico City are in the middle of renegotiating a North American Free Trade Agreement's future. But right now, this is what NAFTA looks like here in the border town of Douglas, Arizona. $1 million in trade creaking its way back and forth through the old port of entry, pulled by about 120 big rigs a day. On the southbound side, it's a crawling line of diesel trucks mixed with cars and pickups heading into Mexico. And then the determined march comes to a stop as trucks are inspected at the Mexican side of the shipping port.
And you have to be very cautious here. It does get very, very tight. The officers are constantly watching their toes. These tires are inches from you.
Isidro Lagos is with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The line of trucks in front of us is starting to back up into the U.S. as Mexico's staging area fills up.
Once they're through, then we can go ahead and toggle that lane and allow additional commercial trucks to come through again till the staging line is full. Once the staging line is full, the process repeats itself.
Truck traffic coming into the U.S. faces an entirely different challenge, mostly a hard right turn into a parking lot about the size of that of a small grocery store.
So that's the main challenge here, just literally this real estate, this rectangle of asphalt where we do our operations is just congested. We've outgrown it.
Douglas is one of only three shipping ports connecting Mexico and Arizona. And this old port was built in 1932. It was never designed to handle the traffic it sees now. But that traffic is about to grow even more. Just across the border, the city of Agua Prieta is building a new rail line. And further down in Sonora, the Guaymas shipping port has expanded to handle $6 billion a year in trade, mostly with China. Cochise County Administrator Ed Gilligan wants his rural county ready to handle its part of that trade.
Right now, that traffic gets divided into three primary ports in Arizona: Mariposa Port in Nogales, San Luis Port near Yuma, and Douglas. But this becomes the least desirable commercial port because it's very congested and not dedicated.
The county's plan is to build an entirely new shipping port 6 miles west of Douglas on what's now a lonely road at the border, using a combination of private investment and federal and state dollars. Shipping is one reason. The other?
You need jobs. And a commercial port of entry, not only in government positions in the area, but also the private industry jobs for shipping and processing, warehouses, distribution centers.
And those jobs are heavily on the minds of planners 100 miles away.
My name is John Moffitt. I'm the Economic Development Director for Pima County.
Moffitt's plan for Pima County involves what's been dubbed the Sonoran Corridor. Bottom line, it's a shorter route to a more fitting place.
The route that we have picked or suggested for the Sonoran Corridor cuts 12 miles off that route.
This proposed corridor would end up creating an enormous hub, tying Tucson's tech giants to the east, to the airport, and down to the shipping port in Nogales. Pima County estimates are 100,000 new jobs in this part of Arizona and $32 billion a year in revenue. The project is still on paper, and its environmental impact is being reviewed, but the competition is very real.
We are seeing some loss from Culiacan and Sinaloa. There is a new highway built by the Mexican government that crosses over that then ties into highways in Texas.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration has already budgeted for one of Arizona's crossing points with Mexico. It plans to spend $250 million to tear down the port of entry near Yuma and rebuild it. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And now from KJZZ's The Show, let's talk about a time when we didn't see the world in color. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
U.S. history didn't begin with the age of color in our films and on our television shows, though sometimes it may seem that way. But significant events like elections, attacks, and huge moments in pop culture that occurred prior to the 1960s are often seen and locked into our memories in black and white. A new series on the Smithsonian Channel called America in Color reimagines decades of U.S. history from the 1920s through the 60s with colorized footage. Nick Metcalf, executive producer for Arrow Media, which put together America in Color with composite films, is with me to talk about the series. Nick, how much more powerful did the images and film become after being colorized?
There were clear cases where we saw black and white footage, and you have an idea what's going on, but when you saw it restored, because that was also part of the process, to restore the process, we rescanned it, up-resed it to a much higher, better resolution than people were seeing. You could see things in the pictures that were just not clear before. But of course, adding color to it brought it to life, and it didn't make it feel like it was 50, 60, 80, 100 years old. It felt as if, in some cases, it could have been yesterday or even today's news. You could look in shop windows and see things, make out what people were seeing in the shop windows. There were stories that I'm not an American, so they may be more familiar to Americans than they were to me, but there were stories that were really surprising to me. The attempted assassination of FDR just after he'd been elected, but before he took office. That was not a story that was familiar to me, and that really came to life. So many other stories, too, that really, really came to life. We looked as much as we could for home movies, footage that showed ordinary people, families, how they were living, what they were doing. One story that really stuck in my memory, was with the rise of the automobile in the late 1920s, there was a family, a well-to-do family in New England. They had a son, aged 5, who was an early casualty. He was hit by an automobile and killed. And we had a home movie of this child. And that really, really stuck with me. I'm a father, but you just sort of felt, hang on, this is not just the story of the car. This is what it meant for ordinary Americans.
One that is much more well-known, the debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960, which here in America, we always think about the difference between if you heard the debate on the radio or saw it on television. Well, there was a difference because one came across as very vibrant. The other candidate looked as though he was very sweaty and uncomfortable. But if you listened to it on the radio, it seemed as though Nixon may have won the debate. If you watched it on TV, it seemed that Kennedy had won. And then the colorization must have made that feel even more dramatic.
It certainly did. We understood that, too, from the commentators at the time. We understood that some people gave it to Nixon, mostly people who listened on the radio. Other people gave it to Kennedy, mostly the people who watched them. And the colorization, we had to be careful when we did the colorization. Were we being true to it? How did we reflect that? How did we show really what people were seeing? And that was always a real challenge for our colorists. They had to go a long way. They had to really, really dig to make sure that what they were colorizing was authentic and that they had checked everything really, really properly before they applied the color to things.
Do you think colorization in this current age is even more vital, even though it's controversial for some, because there is a competition for shorter attention spans? Perhaps people are less interested in history if they can't see it in color on their tablet or their laptop or whatnot.
It's totally a way of bringing the past back to life. I have kids who don't want to look at black and white footage, and it seems to me that's terrible. There are so many great stories, one, and I think it's important to know the history of your own nation. And this is a way of bringing that history back to life so that people look at it and they don't feel they're doing their duty. They really are interested. There are a lot of interesting stories there. And if we can make them play properly, job done.
When Ted Turner, who owned Turner Classic Movies here, had decided that he wanted to colorize some classics, Casablanca was one that came to mind, and people were really upset saying, you're messing with what the artist wanted. What do you say to people who think, well, colorization is taking it away from the actual feeling of putting ourselves of what things were like back then? There was not colorization of TV or many films until the mid-century.
The distinction I make is between films or anything where somebody has made creative decisions about how something should look, as opposed to newsreels and so on, where people were just using cameras to record events around them. They were using the tools that were available at the time. I think most news people would have used color cameras if they were available. And I don't think we're taking anything away from their work by adding color and bringing their work up to date. I think actually what we're doing is sharing their work, the really important work they did, and making it available to a bigger, wider audience. People still want to see Casablanca. Putting it in color is not really going to make it available to a new audience. If you're interested, Casablanca is a great film and doesn't need colorizing.
You alluded to how the stories were connected, how they were put together when we talk about decade by decade. How did the writing come to fit things together? How did you decide to put all that package together to make it so it wasn't just, okay, these are very interesting moments. How do we form that linkage with the words as well as the images?
Wow, there was a lot of thinking and a lot of discussion went into that because, of course, if you're telling the story of America decade by decade, you could just end up with a list of this happened in 1921, this happened in 1922, which nobody's really going to be interested in. So we had to find the way through it. What made sense of the events? So we had to find some themes, some strands that would work for each show. And it was remarkable that we found themes that worked across the whole series. But it was very important to us that we could find a through narrative, a way that was going to make sense of those events and connect them in a way that was going to be interesting for the audience and made sense.
Nick Metcalf is the executive producer of Arrow Media. We're talking about the new Smithsonian Channel series, America in Color. Nick, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Mexico is a country that has been torn in half by the war on drugs. Tens of thousands have been killed there in the last decade. Now the country wants to join others in allowing the commercialization of medical marijuana. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Jorge Valencia reports on a new effort to legalize a crop still considered lucrative on the black market.
Margarita Garfias lives in a typical middle-class building here. I rang the doorbell.
Hola, ¿qué pasa?
¿Eres Margarita?
Sí.
Mucho gusto.
And found a spacious living room, a balcony, and three rooms for her, her husband, and their two children.
Se llama Carlos Antonio Avilés y tiene 13 años.
Carlos is the young one, and just after birth, he suffered a cardiac arrest and was soon after diagnosed with a near loss of brain function. He's 13 now.
A partir de ese momento, pues nos entendimos con la epilepsia y nos entendimos con la
Garfias says she's become well acquainted with Carlos's epilepsy and other ailments.
Enfermarse en nuestro país es cosa de ricos porque
she says sarcastically that only rich people can afford to get sick in Mexico. On months when Carlos has wound up hospitalized, the medical bills have been well over $2,000. And then early last year, she started giving Carlos something she got on the black market. Oil extracted from marijuana. A small jar cost her about $35.
Más conectado como ahorita que me está viendo y está escuchando lo que estoy diciendo porque antes, o sea, de plano.
She turns to Carlos and says that he's more connected now. He's looking at me, he's listening, she says. The seizures seem to be in the past. President Enrique Peña Nieto approved last month a law delegating the health ministry with writing rules for the medical use of marijuana. But at least until then, what Garfias is doing is illegal. José Luis Oliveros Usasiaga was a conservative member of Congress who opposed the legislation.
Mi oposición es, por supuesto, la adicción.
He says his opposition is to addiction.
Me parecía que era ponerles a un niño una pistola, a un niño de 12 años.
It felt like giving a child a gun to play with, Oliveros says, and most lawmakers agreed with him. But a few court rulings sided with the use of hemp oil and the recreational use of marijuana. This prompted the health ministry to organize public forums and President Peña Nieto to eventually give a speech at the United Nations.
Señor presidente, distinguidos jefes de estado.
Peña Nieto hinted at the human toll of the drug war. Here he is through an interpreter.
Ante las limitaciones del paradigma prohibicionista.
Given the limits of the prohibitionist paradigm, we must deal with the international issue of drugs from the perspective of human rights.
In his speech, Peña Nieto said his administration would push to allow the medical use and scientific research of marijuana.
Thousands of lives depend on this. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
So does this mean Mexico suddenly is going to legalize recreational like Colorado or medical like Arizona?
No. We're still far from that.
Alejandro Madrazo heads the Drug Policy Institute at Mexico's Center for Research and Teaching in Economics. He says given the government's no to drugs, tough on crime history, he expects the health ministry to issue very conservative rules. Potentially, this means only the use of hemp oil, as is the case in conservative states like North Carolina. But it also means Mexican pharmaceutical companies could be allowed to patent marijuana products.
Because of the trade treaties that Mexico has subscribed, the patents made here in Mexico would immediately have to be respected elsewhere in the world as marijuana becomes legal for medical use.
The health ministry has until the end of the year to issue its rules. In the meantime, mothers like Margarita Garfias say they're not going to wait.
Pues no. O sea, no. La verdad, no me preocupo.
Garfias says breaking the law doesn't worry her. She says she'd rather get arrested than see her son get sick. Jorge Valencia, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
An E. coli outbreak on the Utah-Arizona border has now grown to 11 confirmed cases. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports.
Most of those affected are children, including two who died. The outbreak is in the community of Short Creek, which includes Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah, and is home to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The source of the outbreak has not been determined, but the Southwest Utah Public Health Department says that water testing shows no E. coli in the drinking water. The agency is also working in conjunction with the Mojave County Health Department, as well as state departments in both Arizona and Utah. Residents in the area are advised not to consume raw milk or any previously purchased ground beef until further notice. Symptoms of E. coli include bad stomach cramps, diarrhea, and vomiting. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
Now let's look at developments in education. Here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
AZ Merit is Arizona's standardized statewide assessment for students, and the majority of students underperform on these exams. According to the Arizona Republic, unofficial statewide results show that despite this, there is continual gradual improvement since the test first started being used in 2015. The results of the test will be used to determine a letter grade for public schools, rating them between A and F. Those grades will be released in September. And here with us for a few minutes to talk about the testing results and student progress is Ricardo Cano, education reporter for the Arizona Republic. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ricardo, what are some important specifics you found out about the numbers?
So, the scores this year show basically the kind of growth that we saw last year. So, across the board, you saw improvement by a handful of percentage points, 1 or 2% in the passing rates. It's important to note, third grade reading, the scores went up. It's 43% of kids are passing it now. But you're also seeing the same trends as well. The distribution of the scores is still tilting toward the minimally proficient and partially proficient categories, which are the lowest categories in the test.
Now, some people may ask the question, we're still seeing a lot of underperforming, though. Are the trends going up enough, in a sense, to quell some of those fears that people may have? Well, gosh, the numbers are still not very good.
It's difficult to say. It's important to note that the letter grades, the AZ Merit test, and the learning standards that have been in place for the last couple of years have all been part of the statewide effort to boost student achievement. The big picture goal here. We did reach out to a couple state leaders who weren't quite ready to comment yet on the results. So it is difficult to say whether this rate of growth that we're seeing, a handful of percentage points here and there, is what state leaders had envisioned when they, enacted these policies.
Have you spoken with anyone who's indicated whether they think the test maybe is a little bit difficult at this point, or whether the way that people are teaching in courses is matching up in such a way that doesn't quite work yet?
Well, the consensus is the test is a lot more rigorous than AIMS. The test that kids took in previous years, and the reason for that is it asks open-ended questions. It's focused more on critical thinking, and so when the test first came out in 2015, that's advocacy groups, educators were cautioning the public that, hey, expect these scores to be low. they're going up, but again, the big question here is whether or not they're going up fast enough.
Were you able to break down the numbers in any way that indicates certain parts of the state, certain areas with maybe more opportunity, less opportunity, more resources, less resources, were certain areas doing better or worse than others?
So the state's not going to release, you know, the school level results until September. But, you know, when we reported on this last year, we saw a wide variance of proficiency across the state. You know, for example, in Maricopa County last year, you saw, schools improve by 30, 40, 50 percentage points in specific areas of the test, and some schools regressed by as many percentage points as well. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, when those results do come out in a couple months, what the trends are there, because that's where it gets a little bit wonky.
One other thing for you. When we started, I mentioned this being used to determine letter grades for schools A through F. Can you take us through kind of a Cliff's Notes version of how that'll work based on the determination of the score? How will that affect whether a school gets an A, B, C, whatever it may be?
So the State Board of Ed is going to determine those cut scores in August. So we don't quite know yet what an A-rated school is going to be, and you know, how proficient are your kids going to have to be to get an A, you know, grade. But you know, it does appear that the state is going to set those cut scores to align with the reality of where those scores are right now. So you know, they were talking about it earlier this year that, you know, in order to get an A grade, you know, half your kids have to be proficient. And so, you know, statewide, we haven't cracked a 50% proficiency rate right in any of the categories, but that is kind of the bar that they're looking at as of now. And it appears that they're going to raise it in the years, you know, assuming that we continue to see the kind of growth that we're seeing in the scores.
Ricardo Cano covers education for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And finally this week in business news, Arizona has hundreds of thousands of cattle and dairy cows and only a handful of veterinarians to tend to the herds. Most vet students come out of school saddled with huge loan debt and go into lucrative family pet practices. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports on how the state and local schools are trying to get more vets into rural areas that need them most.
When equine veterinarian Candace Chintas got a call at 8 p.m. that a horse was badly wounded after getting spooked by fireworks around the 4th of July, she didn't hesitate to drive 40 minutes to help.
He was starting to get a little panicky and his gum color was pretty bad, so we ended up having to do kind of an emergency tracheotomy right there in the field.
The horse had a deep puncture wound near his neck that made it hard to breathe. Today, she's back on the ranch north of Marana for a checkup.
We do have airflow through there.
The horse can breathe now through his tracheotomy and eat with no problems, which Chintas says is a great sign.
He's got a little bit of a road ahead of him, but I'm pretty optimistic.
Late night calls, emergency surgeries, and remote patients. That's the kind of chaos Chintas says comes with the job of being a large animal vet.
The job in general is, I mean, it's tough. It's long, often unpredictable hours, a lot of driving.
Chintas graduated from vet school last May before starting a private practice in Avra Valley. She had to go out of state because Arizona's only vet school opened just a few years ago, and that left her more than $300,000 in debt.
I had kids, I have a husband, you know, I had to pay out-of-state tuition. It's stressful.
Vet students typically graduate with large debt and find lucrative work treating pets. Taking care of animals that end up on your plate, like cows and pigs, is a tougher sell.
The return on their investment to go into food animal medicine is not very great. A lot of them have shifted more towards the small animal and equine side of practices.
Dr. Peter Munshank is the state veterinarian. He says there's a shortage of food animal vets in rural Arizona. New grads don't want to move to areas where they have to cover huge stretches of land to get from feedlot to feedlot and check up on the herds. That, Munshank says, can lead to food animals that are sicker longer and produce less. The state ag department partnered with Midwestern University in Glendale, Arizona's only vet school, led by Dean Tom Graves.
Just like there are food deserts, I consider vast areas of the state of Arizona to be veterinary deserts.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has a program to entice vets to do more food animal practice by offering student loan forgiveness if they work in these shortage areas. There are several of these areas in rural counties like Cochise, Yuma, and Navajo, but there's also one in Maricopa County. Graves says agriculture is consolidating to more cattle and fewer places spread farther apart.
Veterinary medicine is changing just like agriculture is changing. Veterinary medicine is consolidating too. It's not all the small veterinary practice on the corner like it used to be.
The University of Arizona believes it could have a solution to lessen student debt by offering a veterinary school that would graduate students in only 3 years. Provost Andrew Comrie says the goal is to keep students in state.
We have lots of the building blocks in place already, and with an innovative new curriculum, we thought this would be a really smart thing to do.
The U of A's first run at accreditation was rejected last year. Now the school is restarting the process and hopes to be approved in the spring of 2019.
We want to be sure that we can do that, but do it in a way that really substantially lowers the costs for students, particularly for Arizonans, to attend here.
Marana vet Candace Chintas came back to Arizona to practice because it's what she loves to do, though the debt won't go away anytime soon.
I would do it again in a heartbeat, but it's definitely kind of a little big black cloud following you around everywhere.
Chintas couldn't take advantage of the USDA loan forgiveness program because she didn't want to leave her family again. And it may take more than that program to lure large animal vets like her to the rural areas that need them most. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fortke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.